But there is one item he didn't return.
And what was that?
Well, it was something I wanted. A little statue.
Statue of what?
A fat girl. The Venus of Willendorf.
Elefante wondered if he was dreaming. A statue of a fat girl. The governor's daughter was like that. A beautiful one. Could this be a trick? A coincidence?
Is that the name of a soap?
He asked. The governor smirked at him, irritated.
I'm just asking, Elefante said.
Macy said it was the most valuable piece in his collection.
Why was that?
I can't say. Macy knew why, but I don't know those things. It's reddish gold. It's very small, made of stone. No bigger than a bar of soap.
If it's not gold, why is it worth so much?
The governor sighed. I'm thicker than a bag of spuds when it comes to art, son.
I don't know.
Like I said, I had to look up the word reliquary 5 times before I understood it. This statue was in one of those reliquary things. A tiny container, like a coffin, the size of a bar of soap. It's from thousands of years ago. Macy said the box alone was worth a fortune. He said the little fat girl, the Venus of Willendorf, was worth more than anything he had.
Then it likely lives in one of those big castles in Europe where the welcome mats printed in Old English, and he was holding the fake. Or the real ones living in a museum. How come it's not in the museum? A museum would know if it's a fake, by the way.
So what? Son, your pop and I were in prison with several sweet-tongued buncos who could sell ice to an Eskimo. These blokes could even out your bank account to a flat zero faster than a fly can mount shit. They knew more insurance swindles, bank diddles, and hand tricks than a Philadelphia bartender. Smooth as toffee, these fellas. And each one will tell you that most times the trout who gets hooked or bamboozled hushes up tight about it. They want that kind of news kept quiet. The fancy hoofers running your museums are no different. If they're holding a fake, why would they blast it to the world? So long as a cat is paying a shilling to eyeball it, who's to know the difference?
Elefante was silent, taking this in.
You think I'm having you on? The governor asked.
Maybe. Did you ever ask your brother why it was worth so much?
No, I didn't ask him. I took it before he changed his mind. Then he died.
The Venus of Willendorf. That sounds like the name of a soup.
It's not a soup. It's a fat girl, the governor insisted.
I knew a fat girl in high school who was a real treasure, but nobody made a statue of her.
Well, this one will fit in the palm of your hand. I stashed it before I went to prison. Your father got out 2 years before me. I was afraid someone would find it, so I told him to fetch it and hold it for me. He told me he did. So you have it, someplace.
Elefante held his hands out. I swear on the Blessed Virgin, my papa didn't tell me where he put it.
Nothing.
He just told me about that stupid song you sing about the palm of God's hand.
The governor nodded in satisfaction.
Well, that's something.
That's nothing. How can I look for a thing if I don't know where it is or what it looks like?
She's a fat girl.
There must be 1 million statues of fat girls. Does she have a bump on her nose? Or is she fat like a blob?
Does she look like a horse if you turn her sideways? Are the head and stomach the only parts you want to go pokey at?
Or is it like one of those crappy things where a guy throws paint on a canvas and art slobs cream all over it? Does she have one eye? What?
I don't know what. It's a fat girl from thousands of years ago. And there's a guy in Europe who will pay $3 million cash for it.
You said that before. How do I know he's the real deal?
He's real, all right.
Macy sold him one or two pieces before he died. He told me how to reach the guy, but Macy died while I was in prison. I couldn't call nobody from Sing Sing, so I left it alone. You can end up in an urn in somebody's cemetery playing tricks with a fellow you never seen before and done no business with. I never called him before I went to prison. After I got out, my wife got sick. I had to take care of her, and I didn't want to go back to the joint. Then a couple months ago, when the doctor told me I had this sickness, you see, I called the guy in Europe, and he was still alive. I told him I was Macy's brother and told him what I have. He didn't believe me, so I sent him the one picture I had. I'm an old crook. I'm too stupid to keep copies. Saints be praised, he got the picture and got serious. He calls me almost every week now. He says he can move it. At first he offered $4 million, and I said, "How can you get that much money?" He said, "That's my business. I'll give you 4, because I can sell it for 12 million, or even 15. But you need to get it here." He said he's in Vienna. I smelled a rat then. I almost backed out. I didn't trust him. So I said, "If you're the guy my brother said you are, wire me 10 grand and tell me the name of one thing my brother sold you." He did. I ain't daft. I didn't tell the guy where I lived. He thinks I live in Staten Island. That's the return address I put on the envelope with the picture I sent him. He wired the dough to the bank in Staten Island I told him to. I sent him the 10 grand back and said, "Okay." But I got no muscle to move this thing. I can't get it to Europe now. Even if I could, I wouldn't go all the way over there and have the guy lay boots on me or worse, then bag the thing and run off. So I says to him, "You come here and get it." And I let it go for $3 million. You can keep the extra million for your troubles. "I was just talking," the governor said. I thought he'd say, "Get lost." I didn't think he had the balls to do it. He said, "Let me think about it." After a week, he called back and said, "Okay, I'll come get it." That's when I come to you. "You're throwing a pretty long pass here, mister. What makes you think I'd give it to you, or to him, if I found it?" Elefante said. "Because you're your father's son. I ain't just flying it, son. I asked around about you. See, your papa and me, we knew who we were. We were always little guys, moving guys. We never wanted muscle or trouble. We moved stuff. This guy from Europe I'm talking to, he's a head guy. He talks smart, with an accent, smooth. Head guys like that are always one step ahead of you. No matter how smart you think you are, they got a leg up on you. That's why they're head guys. You fool with a head guy, you better be the full shilling. Your papa always said, you were the full shilling." Elefante thought that one over and said softly, almost to himself, "I'm not really a head guy." "For 3 million chips, you are." The governor was silent a moment, then continued. "I took it as far as I could. I called the guy and said, 'Let's arrange a meet.' He said, 'Put it in a locker and let me come get it, and I'll leave your dough.' That was the idea. We meet at Kennedy, make the switch in a locker there, and go on. We didn't talk about the exact switch, how we'd do it, but I agreed on the locker bit. Then work out the last bit and go make your money, for Christ's sakes. How can I do that if I don't know where the statue is?" "You did know," Elefante said. "You had it before my papa did." "He stashed it." The governor paused. "Look, I had it before I went to prison.
or I couldn't tell my wife about it. She'd already spent my dough on fucking bagels. The statue wasn't in a safe place. I told your papa where it was when we were in Sing Sing. He got out 2 years ahead of me. He agreed to get it and hold it. I told him, after I get out, when things cool off, I'll come for it. And I'll give you a piece of it. He said okay. But he had that stroke in prison just before he got out, and I didn't see him no more. I tried passing word to him when he was in the prison hospital, but he was gone before I could reach him. They released him after his stroke. He passed word to me after he got out. He sent a letter. It said, "Don't worry. I got that little box of yours. It's clean and safe and in the palm of God's hand, like that little song you used to sing. So I know he got it somehow. And I know he kept it someplace."
In God's hand. What's that mean?
I don't know. He just said the palm of God's hand.
You got the wrong guy then.
My pop didn't write that letter. He never went to church. Weren't you Catholic?
My mother dragged me to St. Augustine till I was big enough to quit. But my father never went. Until he was dead, he never went into a church. We had his funeral. That's when he went to church.
Maybe he left it in a church. Or in his coffin.
Elefante thought for a moment.
His mother did say she wanted his father's coffin exhumed so she could get in the same grave. And Joe Peck had promised to do the job himself.
The thought of that pea-brained idiot, Joe Peck, digging through his father's remains, flipping his papa's corpse around, working through the pockets of his dad's best suit, drilling through his papa's brains with a screwdriver, trying to find whatever the hell the fat girl's name was that was worth $3 million, threw him. And for a moment, Elefante felt out of breath. After a moment, he regained his composure and said,
"He wouldn't leave it in a church. He had no contact with churches. There's no one in any church he'd trust. He wouldn't be dumb enough to bury it with himself either. He wouldn't do that to my mother."
"I agree," the governor said. "But you have a storage place. You move stuff."
"I look through every single storage rental we have, the ones I have access to."
"What about the ones you don't have access to?"
"I guess I could get in them," Elefante admitted. "But that'll take time."
"Time I ain't got," the governor said. "The guy who wants to buy, he won't deal with nobody else. You don't call this type of guy. He calls you. I'm stalling him. I told him I had to think about the deal. He's skittish. He won't like it if there's a second person involved. As it is, I'm thinking he might make a move on me regardless, which is the other reason I'm hoping you'll dig it up."
And there it was, Elefante thought bitterly. He's got nobody.
If a big shot in Europe wants a fucking artifact worth an arm and a leg, and the only stumbling block between him and that dough is a bagel maker and his daughter,
well, there it is.
"I thought you told him you were in Staten Island," Elefante said. "People like that can find you," the governor said. "On the other hand, he's like my brother Macy. These guys are fanatics. We got a little maneuvering room. I let him know that the minute I smell a rat, the statue is gone forever. Flushed down the toilet, peeled to pieces, tossed in the river. But I still think of Melissa here. So when I came to you, well, with you, knowing how your father was, I know I have at least one guy on my team who won't cut and run."
Elefante was silent.
"My team," he thought. "How the hell did I get on his team?"
The governor sat up on the couch a moment, arched his back awkwardly, then reached under the couch and pulled out an envelope. "One more thing," he said. He handed the envelope to Elefante, who instantly recognized the painful scrawls of his father's handwriting, which toward the end of his life was shaky and big. The envelope was addressed to the governor.
"Where'd you get this?"
"Your papa sent this to me when I was in prison." Elefante opened the envelope. Inside was a simple greeting card with a picture of the old Cos docks, taken perhaps in the 1940s, the familiar Statue of Liberty in the distance. On the back was taped the traditional Irish blessing, obviously clipped from a book or a newspaper. "May the road rise up to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face, the rains fall soft upon your fields, and until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand." Next to that was a sketch in his father's hand of a tiny box. Inside the box was a wooden stove with small bits of firewood, crudely drawn, and a cross above it. The box had five sides. On one of the sides was a circle with a stick figure drawn in the middle, its arms outstretched.
"If this weren't his handwriting, I wouldn't believe he'd drawn it," Elefante said.
"Do you recognize anything?"
"No."
"It's an Irish blessing," the governor said.
"I figured that much," Elefante said. "But what's with the firebox and the firewood?"
"Do you have a storage locker with something like that in it?" the governor asked.
"No. That box could be anything. A garage, a house, a milk crate, a cabin in the woods. It could be anywhere."
"Yes, it could," the governor said. "But where would Guido Elefante go?"
Elefante thought a long moment before he answered. "My father," he said dryly, "never went anywhere. He never went three blocks outside the Cos district, hardly ever. He couldn't walk very well. Even if he could, he wouldn't go far. Maybe to the store in Bay Ridge once in a while that sold food from Genoa. There was a place on 3rd Avenue that sold Genoese stuff, focaccia, cheese mostly from the old country. But he hardly went there."
"How do you know?"
"He never went anywhere, I tell you. He went to the boxcar every once in a while. He went to the storage place hardly ever. Maybe three times my whole life I saw him walk in there. I took care of the storage place, not him."
"What else is around you?"
"Nothing. Just the housing projects. The subway, some abandoned buildings, that's it."
The governor looked at him oddly.
"You sure?"
"I'm sure."
"That box is somewhere. Sure as I'm living, it's sticking out like a blind cobbler's thumb someplace. Somewhere your papa put it."
"How would I know where?"
The governor yawned.
"He's your father," he said sleepily. "A son knows his father."
Elefante stared at the paper in his hands a long time. He wanted to say, "But you weren't my father's son. You don't know how difficult he was. He was impossible to talk to." But instead, he said, "That's not going to be easy." He looked over at the governor. He was talking to himself. The old man had fallen asleep. As quietly as he could, he rose from the rocker, stepped out the door, and slipped silently out into the hallway just as Melissa was coming up the stairs. Chapter 14. Rat. Bunch sat at the table of his dining room in his Bed-Stuy brownstone and chewed a chicken wing. A huge spread of wings and a platter of barbecue sauce were on the table. He motioned to the young man seated at the table across from him.
"Help yourself, young brother."
Lightbulb, Deems Clemens' right-hand man, reached deep into the chicken wings, his fingers scooping out two, and then dipped them in the sauce.
He sucked down the tender meat and reached for the plate again.
"Slow your roll, bro," Bunch said. "The chicken ain't going nowhere."
Lightbulb still ate fast. Too fast, Bunch thought. Either the kid was starving or he might be a dope user already. He guessed the latter. The kid was awful thin and wore long sleeves to cover what might be tracks in his arms. Lightbulb glanced at the end of the table where Earl, fresh from his painful electrocution in Sausage's basement boiler room, silently scratched at a crossword puzzle. His right arm in a sling and his head bandaged from where the bottle had smashed him at Soup's coming home party. Earl kept his head down.
"So, tell me about Deems," Bunch said.
"What do you want to know?"
Lightbulb asked.
"How'd he win the flagpole?"
he asked.
"That's the busiest section of the cause. Who was doing business there before Deems took over?"
"I want the flagpole plaza, by the way," Lightbulb said, "if this works out."
"How about a flagpole up your ass? I asked you about how Deems won it. I didn't ask you what you want."
"I'm just saying, I can do a better job than him. I'd need the flagpole to do it."
"Who you think you're talking to, kid? Santa Claus?"
"I don't care about your needs. You ain't done nothing so far other than say what you need and lick your nasty fingers while eating my chicken."
Lightbulb blinked and started in.
"Back when we was all playing baseball, Deems had an older cousin named Rooster. Rooster started selling first. He was making so much bank we quit ball to work under him. We ran customers to him, junkies, on the street. White boys from New Jersey cruising through like that. Rooster got killed by somebody who tried to rob him. So Deems took over.
Just like that. Y'all just let Deems be top dog."
"Well, he done some things, Deems did."
"Like?"
"Well, a boy named Mark Bumpus was the first guy. He dead now."
"How'd he get that way? Was he a heavy sleeper? Did he fall down a flight of stairs?"
"Deems set him up."
"How so?"
"Well, Rooster died while we was all in jail. When we come out, Mark Bumpus ran things."
"And Deems didn't mind, even though Rooster was his cousin."
"We got like $40 a day. That's a lot of money."
"And Deems didn't say nothing."
"I gotta back up a minute to tell it right," Lightbulb said. "See, we was all in Spofford together," Lightbulb said, referring to the juvenile center. "Me, Beanie, Sugar, Deems, and Bumps. Deems and Bumps got into it in Spofford in the rec room. It wasn't over Rooster. He was already dead."
"Over what then?"
"The TV. Deems wanted to watch baseball, Bumps didn't. They got into it. Deems whipped up on Bumps pretty bad. Then Deems' grandfather visited and gave Deems $50. The food was bad in Spofford. So Deems went to the commissary and bought some rice and beans. He shared it with his boys, me, Beanie, Sugar. Bumps wasn't his boys. When Bumps asked Deems for some rice and beans, Deems said, 'No, I just share with my boys.' So that night, Bumps and a couple of his friends caught Deems alone in the shower and cut him up bad. They took his rice and beans and the rest of that $50. Deems never forgot that," Lightbulb said. "Bumps got out of Spofford before Deems did. When he come out Spofford a few months later, Bumps had taken over the plaza. Bumps was hot, man, selling dope, weed, acid, everything. By that time, most of us was out of Spofford. We all needed money, so we went to work for Bumps. He paid $40 a day. He even hired Deems. He told Deems, 'Forget all that stuff from Spofford. You're with me now. We boys now.' Deems ran customers to Bumps better than any of us. Deems knew how to find dope heads. Deems would go all the way downtown to get customers and run them over to Bumps. It got so that Bumps would let Deems carry dope to his far-off customers because Bumps was rolling. He was selling to everybody. That's when Deems got him. He sent Deems out with 30 grams of coke to this Jamaican guy out in Hollis, Queens. Deems switched out the dope for some white soap flakes and flour and gave the bag to the guy. The guy used it and damn near died. He called on the phone, and Deems had Beanie answer the telephone, and Beanie told the guy, fuck off. So the guy got his revenge. Deems took a bunch of us to the top of Building 9 where we could wait to watch the ants come.
What ants?
It don't matter. Just a bunch of ants that crawl up there every year, but you can see the plaza from there. You could see Bumps out there working. Deems said, remember my rice and beans when we was in juvie? I'ma square that with punk-ass Bumps. Just watch. Sure enough, a couple of nights later, this pretty Jamaican girl come around to the flagpole saying to Bumps she wanted some dope but didn't have no money. She offered to, you know, service his rod if he let her shoot up afterward. Bumps said okay. He followed her to the alley behind the plaza, and them Jamaicans was waiting for him. They damn near killed him. Cut his face down his forehead, all down his eye. Oh, man, messed him up. They left him like that. Soon as they started whipping on him, Deems ran off the roof. He run off soon as they started cutting Bumps up. The minute them Jamaicans left Bumps laying in the alley, Deems came out the back door of Building 9 and ran over to Bumps holding a steaming pot of rice and beans. He must have had it cooking in his house. He said, here's your rice and beans, Bumps. He poured that whole pot on him. Bumps got crippled from that. He was never the same. He got out the dope game altogether. He tried fooling around on the dock, smuggling, trying to make money that way. He didn't last long. He was walking in the elephant's territory then. You ever heard of the elephant?
I heard of him.
Yeah? Well, that's the last anybody seen of Bumps. Lightbulb paused, then reached for another piece of chicken and dipped it in the sauce. That's how Deems won the flagpole, he said.
Why didn't somebody from Bump's crew take the flagpole plaza back? Bunch asked.
First of all, that ain't the only thing Deems done, bro. Second, ain't nobody smarter in the cause than Deems.
So, people are afraid of him?
Well, yes and no. The old folks in the cause like Deems. He was a church boy. The church folks sit around the flagpole in the mornings and talking bullshit. Deems stays out of their way. He don't run his dope till the afternoons when the church folks leave the plaza. He don't allow it before then. He's funny about them church people. He don't want to make the church people mad. Some of them's old, but they can cause trouble. Some of them will shoot, you know.
I do know.
Here Bunch glanced disgustedly at Earl, whose face was shoved so deep into his crossword puzzle he appeared to be cleaning the puzzle with his nose. Plus, Deems was the star on the Cause House's baseball team, Lightbulb said. That sport coat's old team. Deems' father wasn't around. His mother drank a lot. Deems' grandfather raised him, and his grandfather and sport coat was buddies. That's why Sport Coat ain't dead yet, I guess. Because Deems was on his baseball team, and his grandfather was all for him doing that. He could play the shit out of some baseball. When his grandfather died, he left all that and went to selling the flour and rock. Good as he was in baseball, that's how good he is at moving that dip. Deems thinks stuff out. All day long, he thinks how to move that powder. He's to himself, too. He don't chase girls too much. He don't watch TV. And he don't forget. If you cross Deems, he'll let a year pass. 2 years, even. I seen him walk up to guys and choke them till they fall asleep for stuff they did to him 2 years before that they forgot all about. I seen him put a hot iron to a guy's neck to get the name of somebody who stole from him so long ago, ain't nobody remembered it but Deems. He's smart, bro. Like I said. He ain't been in jail since Spofford. He don't carry a knife. Don't carry a gun. He's organized. He pays little kid watchers to set on the buildings and watch out. He got watchers in the plaza. They got the weapons, not him.
So, what's the matter with him now?
He's too strict, Mr. Bunch. He wants to be a cop now. Before he became a punk and let Sport Coat shoot him, he would sell to everybody. Now he won't sell to grandmothers. He won't sell to little kids. He won't sell to nobody from the church. He don't want nobody smoking near the church or robbing the church or falling asleep in the door of the church like that. And like if somebody beats up their girlfriend over something, he won't sell to them. He wants to be telling folks what they should be doing. That's why Sport Coat shot him, I think. Because he got pussified, talking about going back to baseball and all this, ordering folks around, telling folks what to do instead of making that money. It ain't gonna be long before the watch houses come take our territory. It's only a matter of time. What's that I'm hearing about you saying Deems wants Joe Peck to supply him? Lightbulb glanced at Earl.
Did I say that?
Lightbulb said. I'm asking if he said it. Did he say that or not? Bunch asked. Lightbulb paused. He had told that to Earl in confidence, a kind of extra carrot he'd dangled to Earl to get himself an audience with the boss. But he realized now, looking at Bunch's operation for the first time, the brownstone, dilapidated on the outside and polished to a sheen on the inside, the busy factory a block away that Earl had shown him full of employees processing heroin, the large cars, and the fabulous modern furniture of Mr. Bunch's dining room, that this man was a major roller. Bunch, Lightbulb realized, was a real-life gangster. He realized, too late, that he was in over his head. A cone of silence enveloped the room as Bunch stared at him, unblinking. Realizing his response could be a death sentence for Deems, Lightbulb said, I might have said it, but I don't know if Deems really meant it. Bunch sat for a moment, looking thoughtful. Then the tension seemed to ease out of him. He spoke softly.
I appreciate you coming by, young blood.
I appreciate you letting me and my man here know you got our best interest at heart. So, I get the flagpole?
I'm gonna give you a break on that, Bunch said, reaching in his pocket and pulling out a roll of crisp bills.
Lightbulb smiled, relieved, grateful, and felt a sudden burst of guilt. I just want to say, I like Deems, Mr. Bunch. We go back a long way, but like I said, he want to be a cop now. That's why I'm here.
I understand, Bunch said calmly.
He slowly, deliberately counted out four $50 bills and slid them across the table to Lightbulb.
Take that and get gone.
Do I get the flagpole?
Can a donkey fly?
Lightbulb seemed confused, but didn't speak at first, then asked, Does that mean yes?
Bunch ignored that. You want a chicken wing on your way out?
Lightbulb, flummoxed, found it suddenly hard to breathe. So, I don't get the flagpole.
I'll think on it.
I done told you everything like I said I would. What do I get now? Bunch shrugged.
You get $200.
You can get a lot with that. Some soup,
a bottle of beer, some poontang. Even get a job with it in some places.
I don't care what you get, so long as you stay out of my business. And if I ever see your face here again, I'll part it with a hammer. Lightbulb's eyes widened. What did I do wrong?
Bunch turned to Earl. He rats his own boy out. Rats out the guy who gave him his own rice and beans in the joint. The guy who gave him food from his own mouth, practically.
and he comes to me saying he wants to work for me.
Dig that, Earl said.
He stood, menacingly. Lightbulb, watching Earl out of the corner of his eye, slid his hand over to the money on the table. Bunch's hand suddenly slammed down on his.
Need I remind you, young brother, to forget us?
No.
Good. Because we will not forget you. Now get.
Lightbulb snatched the $200 off the table and fled. After the front door closed, Bunch shrugged and reached for the newspaper.
We'll get back every penny of that dough.
He's skin-popping now.
Dig that.
Bunch shot an irritated look at Earl.
You mucked it up, man.
I can fix it, Earl said.
You had 3 shots at it already.
You get your head banged in twice, then get shocked like a clown. You're like the 3 Stooges, bro, with a bag full of excuses.
You made it worse.
You said don't kill him. Killing and hurting's different. You hurt a guy. You gotta make so he can't see you, so he can't rat. Taking him out is
something I ain't asked you to do, bro.
Bunch reached for a chicken wing, dipping it in the sauce and chewing slowly as he scoured the newspaper.
The game's changed, Earl.
I should have watched Deems closer. Let me even it out, Bunch. It's my load. Let me carry it. Bunch wasn't listening. He'd placed the newspaper down and was staring out the window. There was so much to think about. Peck says this big shipment from Lebanon is coming soon. He says he's got a dock for it. But that idiot's so dumb he lights up a room by leaving it. And now this crap with this old motherfucker who shot Deems. If we can't shake up an old drunk, how the fuck we gonna run Peck's operation? He shook his head, biting his bottom lip angrily. All my luck is junior grade. Earl felt the same way. He sat in silence, studying his fingers atop the crossword puzzle. His nerves felt as if they were sitting on a razor blade. He'd already been collared twice by that white cop, Potts, who'd promised him he'd look the other way when the cops dropped the hammer on Bunch, if he flipped on Bunch, which Earl had agreed to do with trepidation. But now, sitting before Bunch, he realized he'd underestimated Bunch's cleverness and forgotten the power of his rage, which seemed to ooze off him. If Bunch found him out, he was cooked. That suddenly seemed a possibility. Worse, the old woman from the cause had recognized him as Reverend Harris's son. His father, he felt, was torturing him from the grave.
I can straighten out the old man, Earl said.
Don't need to, Bunch said matter-of-factly. There's a 9:30 train coming in tonight from Richmond. Take my car down to Penn Station in the city and pick up Harold Dean. You can do that without mucking it up, can't you?
We don't need Harold Dean. You think I'm running a summer camp? If Deems convinces Peck to sell to him instead of us, we'll be buying our groceries with green stamps, brother. We're done. Nobody will sell to us. Not Roy and them Italians out in Brighton Beach. Nobody from the West Side. Nobody in Harlem. It's the Elephant's Dock or nothing. Peck's the only one who's still got a line to the Elephant. If Deems convinces Peck to go with him, then he's got the Elephant's Dock too. And we're out of business. Deems has got to go. And Peck. We got to flatten things out, get everything back to zero before that Lebanon thing comes in. I'll talk to the Elephant myself. But first, let's get rid of the old man. What's his name? Something, Sport Jacket, they call him. Whatever the fuck he is, he got to be put to sleep. Now, get off your spine and get Harold Dean. Make sure Harold Dean does the old man first. Nobody in the cause has seen HD. That one will be quick and easy.
Chapter 15.
You have no idea what's coming. Dominic Lafleur of Building 9 spent days apologizing to Bum Bum for starting the fight at Soup Lopez's coming home party. He accidentally ran into her on three separate occasions as she went about her business. The first time, she was coming out of Five Ends. She had gone inside to place a few cans of beans in the pantry, and when she emerged, he happened to be outside, which gave him the opportunity to explain that the doll he tried to give Sportcoat was not bad luck.
"It's a custom back home in Haiti," he said.
When she seemed doubtful, he explained defensively that black Americans had their own rituals. Black-eyed peas on New Year's Day, carrying a raw potato in the left pocket for rheumatism, or holding a copper coin under your tongue during coitus.
"Coitus?" she asked.
"Doing the nature thing," Dominic said. "You hold the copper coin under your tongue during coitus to keep from getting pregnant. My first wife was from Tennessee."
Bum Bum received this information with a snort.
"What did they feed her down there, Smog? I've never heard such nastiness. Anyway, that ain't the same as witchery."
Still, she let him walk her home. The next time, he happened to be across the street from the wall of Jesus painted on the backside of Five Ends Baptist, where she stopped every morning on the way to work to silently pray for the destruction of her ex-husband, who ran off to Alaska, that his testicles might be pressed in a juice maker or lopped off with a saw. Dominic happened to be marveling at the wonderful artistry of the garbage piled high on the back wall of the church under the painting of Jesus. Garbage that the church sexton, Sportcoat, had somehow forgotten to haul to the curb, being that he'd unexpectedly received a bottle of Haitian creation from his wonderful neighbor Dominic that very afternoon, who had supplied it with the hope it would spark a binge and Sportcoat would forget the garbage altogether. Which is exactly what happened. That left Dominic with the task of informing Bum Bum that since they happened to be at Five Ends together on a Tuesday morning when sanitation picked up, it was their civic duty as residents of the cause and respecters of all religions to clean up the house of the Lord, as it wouldn't be right to leave garbage setting right under Jesus' nose for a full week before sanitation came again. Bum Bum muttered that Five Ends' rival church, Mount Tabernacle, puts its trash out faithfully, and Five Ends' garbage was Sportcoat's business, not hers. Plus, she was dressed for work in all white, being a home care attendant. But she agreed that no Christian person in their right mind could walk away while Jesus' painting stood above a pile of garbage, which gave them a full 20 minutes of setting out the garbage that normally took 30 seconds, since Dominic refused to let her dirty her uniform and did all the lifting while he talked. That gave him 20 minutes to explain to Bum Bum what a mojo could do.
"Mojos," he said patiently, as he swung a half-filled garbage bag toward the curb, "can work on a person for miles and miles."
"How many miles?" she asked.
100 miles, 500 miles, 1,000 miles even," he said, marching toward the curb as she followed. "As far away as, say, Alaska."
Bum Bum, standing at the edge of the street in front of the garbage, worked hard to keep the light bulb that went off in her brain from showing in her face. She frowned. So even the Haitian sensation knew about her husband's running off to Alaska. She wondered if he'd heard the part about her ex taking up with a man. Probably, she thought. She shrugged.
"It's better to pray for the saving of an enemy's soul than their ruination," she said. "But tell me about it anyhow,"
and allowed him to walk her to the subway as he explained the magic of rituals. The third time he happened to be passing through her building, Building 17, a good 15-minute walk to her third-floor unit from his own apartment on the fifth floor of Building 9, it was a warm night, and Sam Cooke's "You Send Me" played out the window of an upper apartment
He arrived holding a plate of Haitian marmolet aqua pois poulassoi, cornmeal with beans and stewed chicken. He knocked on her door, holding the plate and the doll, which he had ripped in half. "I'm going to make a pillow out of it," he explained, then handed her the plate and asked her out to the movies. Bum Bum refused. "I'm a Christian woman, and I don't do worldly things," she said firmly. "But I'm going to Five Ends tomorrow morning. We need folding chairs, and Mount Tabernacle is offering us some." "I thought Tabernacle and Five Ends don't get along," Dominic said. "We are Christian people, Mr. Lafleur. Their music is too loud, and they fall out and speak in tongues and so forth when they get filled with the Holy Spirit, and we don't do that here. But the book of Hebrews 12:14 says, strive for peace with everyone, which means Mount Tabernacle too. Plus, my best friend Octavia is a deaconess there, and everybody knows the police is trying to shut our church down for protecting old sport coat, who helped me put in my washing machine, even though housing says I'm not supposed to have one. Mount Tabernacle is with us for sure. We've always gotten along." Thus it was the sight of Dominic Lafleur, Bum Bum, Sister G, and Miss Izzy struggling toward the side door of Five Ends Baptist with 17 folding chairs stuffed inside an old post office dolly, the chairs stacked 6 feet high, that greeted Sergeant Potts Mullen as he swung his Plymouth squad car to the front of Five Ends Baptist Church a week after Soup's big party. Sister G didn't notice him when he pulled up. Her back was to him. He watched as she peeled off from the others and moved to the rear of the church, grabbing an old-fashioned weed chopper from the back wall and stepping into a field of high weeds. The weed cutter was shaped like a golf club, and she swung it high over her head, slaying weeds as she went. Had he driven by the church 3 weeks ago and seen that sight, he would have said to himself the woman looked like a cotton picker on a plantation someplace. But now he saw a woman whose long back reminded him of the sea near the cliffs of Moher in County Clare, the part of Ireland he'd seen when he'd visited, the sea gently pushing against the mountainous shore. She looked beautiful. The three chair haulers at the side door saw him first and quickly moved inside, unstacking the chairs one by one and marching them down the basement stairs without a word. Potts parked the squad car, emerged, and walked past the side door to Sister G, standing in the weeded field out back. She saw him coming, the harbor water sparkling behind him, and stopped swinging, leaning on the weed cutter with her hand on her hip as he came. She was clad in a spring dress covered with azaleas, not ordinary garden clothing, he thought as he approached. Then again, she'd said she was a countrywoman, and countrywomen, as he knew from his mother and grandmother, didn't dress for success. They dressed up and worked in the clothing they had. He walked straight into the weeds to her. When he reached her, she smiled, a small one that bore, he hoped, just a hint of eagerness, then nodded at his patrol car where his young partner Mitch sat in the passenger seat. "Why don't he come?" she asked. "You scared him off," he said. "We don't bite here." "Tell him that. You scared the Jesus out of him last time." She laughed. "We supposed to run Jesus into souls here, not out." "Come to think of it, he was an angel till you laid boots on him and sent him the other direction." The sight of her lovely brown face breaking into laughter and focusing tightly on him as she stood in the dress of azaleas in the sunlit yard of weeds made him feel light again. In that moment, he realized that all the experience of 32 years on the NYPD and all the formal police training in the world was useless when the smile of someone you suddenly care about finds the bow that wraps your heart and undoes it. He wondered when he'd last had that feeling. Indeed, if he'd ever had it at all.
For the life of him, he couldn't remember. Standing there in knee-high weeds, behind an old black church that he'd passed by 100 times over the last 2 decades without so much as a glance, he wondered if he had ever actually been in love, or if love was, as his grandmother used to say, a kind of discovery of magic. He loved the stories she read to him when he was a boy, of kings and seafaring maidens, and sailors gone awry and monsters slain, all for the sake of love. Who is it who throws the light into the meeting on the mountain? It was a poem she loved. He tried to recall the poet's name. Was it Yeats, maybe? He saw her staring at him and realized she was waiting for him to say something. "I think Mitch has lost interest in this case," he managed to say. "Who?" "Mitch, the other officer, my partner."
"Good.
So have I," she said. She shifted the weed cutter to the other side and leaned on it again, one smooth hip thrust outward.
"Or I'm trying to. We truck on here, despite it all. Look at all these weeds."
"You do this often?" She smiled.
"Not enough. You cut them down, they come right back. You cut them again, they come back again. That's their purpose, to keep coming. Everything under God's sun got a purpose in this world. Everything wants to live. Everything deserves life, really.
If everything deserves to live, why kill a weed?" She chuckled. She loved this kind of talk. How was it that he could draw this foolish chatter out of her? Her discourse with her husband, what little conversation they had, was made up of stunted, dry, matter-of-fact grunts about bills paid, church business, the affairs of their 3 grown children who were, thankfully, living away from the cause houses. At 48, most days she awakened feeling like there was nothing left to live for other than her church and her children. She had been 17 when she wed a man 12 years older than her. He had seemed to have purpose, but turned out to have none, other than an affinity for football games and the ability to pretend to be what he was not, to pretend to feel things that he did not feel, to make jokes out of things that did not work for him, and like too many men she knew, daydream about meeting some lovely young thing from the choir, preferably at 3 a.m. in the choir pew. She didn't hate her husband. She just didn't know him. "Well, I could let the weeds grow," she said, "but I'm not a person who knows enough about what should or should not be to leave things as they are when they got no purpose that I can understand. My purpose is to keep this church open long enough to save somebody. That's all I know. If I was a book-learned person, somebody who could use 34 words instead of 3 words to say what I mean, I might know the full answer to your question. But I'm a simple woman, officer. These weeds is a blight to this house of worship, so I goes at 'em. The truth is they do me no harm. They're unsightly to me, but sightly to God. And still I cuts at him. I reckon I'm like most folks. Most times I don't know what I'm doing. Sometimes I feel like I don't hardly know enough to tie my own shoes." "I can tie your shoes for you," he said, his eyes twinkling, "if you can't manage." The comment, offered in the lilt of his Irish brogue, brought her to a blush, and she noticed Miss Izzy standing by the church door, staring in their direction. "What brings you around?" she said quickly. She glanced at Miss Izzy again, who thankfully was called away by Dominic at the basement door. "Better hurry and tell it. My friend Izzy there," she said, nodding at Miss Izzy's back, "is what they call the walking news." "Gossip?" "I wouldn't call it gossip. Everybody knows everybody's business in these projects, so why put a name to it? It's news, one way or the other. Potts nodded and sighed. That's why I come. I have some. Do you now? We arrested a young fella named Earl. We know you know him. Her smile disappeared. How's that? We saw you. One of our guys followed you after the little ruckus over in the plaza last week. You mean Soup's party? Whatever it was, they, without my knowledge, had somebody roll behind you. He saw you and a big giant fella carry Earl out of the projects to the Silver Street subway station. They saw the little deal there, where you closed the turnstiles and you two had a little talk with Earl and sent him on his way. That's a transit authority violation, I'm sorry to say. A pretty big one, to close down a subway station. Sister G, thinking of Calvin in the toll booth, felt the blood rising in her face. It was my idea. I made Calvin do it. It wasn't but 10 minutes till the train came. I don't want him fired from his job on account of my foolishness. What were you planning on doing? I wasn't going to have the man thrown on the tracks, if that's what you mean. What did you want? I wanted him out of the cause, and I got him out. You can take that back to the precinct or tell it to the judge. Or I'll tell it to the judge myself. That fella was hunting somebody. Sport coat, most likely. That's why he come here. I'm told that wasn't his first time in the cause, neither. We wanted him gone. Why didn't you call the police? She chortled. It wasn't a crime for him to come to the plaza party. Somebody threw a bottle and he got struck over the head by accident. I'm telling you what God's pleased with. The truth. That's exactly what happened. He was in a fog when he come to. As God would have it, the darn thing didn't kill him, just knocked him out. I reckoned he'd come out of it swinging. So I had Soup carry him to the subway and told Calvin to shut the turnstiles down till the first train come. I didn't want nobody to get hurt. That's all there is to it. That's called taking matters into your own hands. Call it what you will or may. It's done now. You should have called us. Why we got to have the police around every time we has a simple party? Y'all don't watch out for us. Y'all watch over us. I don't see y'all out there standing over the white folks in Park Slope when they has their block parties. We was just having a celebration for poor old Soup, who went to jail a boy and come out a man. Much of a man, I'd say. Where's a man like him gonna get a job, big as he is? Soup wouldn't hurt a fly. Do you know, when he was a tiny boy, he was scared to come out the house. Used to stay inside and watch television all day, Captain Kangaroo and Mr. Rogers and them type shows. The kiddie shows. Been doing it since he was a child. He's a Muslim now. Can you believe it? All that work we put into him here. She nodded at the church, then shrugged. Well, as long as he's got God in his life some kind of way. She shifted her weight off the weed cutter and absently swiped at a few weeds near her feet on the cracked, dry dirt. So you and Kitty Show guy and the token booth guy shut down the station, Potts said. Sister G stopped swiping at the weeds and looked at him. Her face melted into the slightly angry expression she had worn when they first met. She saw his eyes slice away from hers and cut to the ground. Was that shame she saw in his eyes? She wasn't sure. I shut the station down. Me, alone. Potts removed his cap, wiped his brow with his sleeve, and replaced it on his head. She watched him closely. Every movement, she observed, was that of a man trying to maintain emotional control of himself. He didn't seem angry,
or even disappointed. Rather, he seemed resolved to a kind of silent sadness that made her, despite herself, feel drawn to him, for she knew the feeling well. She found the whole business a little worrying, that common ground, but also wildly and almost terrifically exciting. She'd forgotten what that felt like. After 31 years of being married, the last five of which had been a trial of silent suffering, of infrequent bursts of small, almost minuscule, useless affection, she felt a part of herself she thought long dead, shaking loose and awakening.
"Shutting down the station. I don't want to know about it," he said. "Neither does the precinct. Neither does transit. I made sure of that. But we arrested that fella Earl. I arrested him. And that's something you ought to know about."
"Why?"
"He's a suspect."
"So's a lot of people."
"Okay. He's more than a suspect. He's no junkie. He's what you call a strong-arm guy, a smart one. He knocks out teeth here and there. But he's not a concern now. No worries there. We got the goods on him. We're working with him, or he's working with us. That's all I can tell you. That's between you and me. So you don't have to worry about him coming around again. But the guy he works for, we don't have him, and he is somebody to worry about."
"What's that got to do with sport coat?"
"How many times do I have to say it? Your guy kicked off something big. I don't know that he meant to. In fact, I'm sure he didn't. But he's got the wrong end of things. There's a drug war brewing. You don't want your guy or your church in the middle of it. These drug lords are a different breed. They don't play by the rules like the old crooks did. There's no handshake or silent agreements, no looking the other way. Nobody's safe. Nothing's sacred. There's too much money involved."
"What's that got to do with us?"
"I told you before. Turn your guy in and back out of it. Stay out of the way. We can protect him."
Sister G felt hot. She looked up into the sky, squinting, then raised a long, lovely brown arm to shade her eyes as she peered at him.
"I'm burning up out here. Can we get in the shade?"
It was as if she'd asked him to go to the beach, or swimming, or to lounge in a cool air-conditioned library someplace, to sit and read Irish poems, the kind he liked, the simple ones, Symbols of Erie, and the Diaries of Humphrey, the ones his grandmother loved and taught him. She walked past him, wading through the weeds to the back of the church building, out of view of the side door where Dominic, Bum Bum, and Miss Izzy were loading chairs. He followed behind, noting the shapely figure beneath the dress. When she reached the shade of the old building, a cinder block structure built on a foundation of solid red bricks, she placed her back to the wall just underneath the faded painting of Jesus with his arms spread and leaned against it, propping her foot on the wall, showing a golden brown knee. He faced her, standing just inside the shade, his hands clasped in front of him, rubbing his thumbs, trying not to stare. Everything she did, Potts realized, every move, the gentle arcs of her neck and mouth, the way she held herself erect along the wall and stretched a long arm out to wipe her forehead with gentle, silk-like smoothness, made something inside him want to kneel down.
"Sport coat ain't hard to find," she said. "He's around. You want to go get him, go ahead. It's not going to change nothing. Deems is still out there slinging poison like clockwork every day at the flagpole at noon. He hasn't moved a peep toward bothering old sport coat, far as I know. Fact is, he's more polite now than before. They say he's changed a little. He don't sell to grandmothers or little kids now. Of course, that don't matter, since they ain't got to do but walk 5 blocks to the watch houses and get what they want. Some folks send their children to buy drugs for them. Imagine that. Sending a little child, 9, 10 years old, out to buy drugs. This project's was never that way. What are we doing wrong? She seemed so sad as she said it. It was all Potts could do to stop himself from placing an arm around her right there, right behind the church, in the shade under Jesus' sad, painted gaze, and saying, "It's all right. I got you." Instead, he said, "I'm speaking as a friend, Miss. You, all of you, need to step back and let us do our job here. Arrest Deems, then. That'll make it easier. We arrest him today. 10 guys will be in his place tomorrow. You arrest 10 guys, 10 more guys will come. You know why? They're being bailed out by the same man who sent that kid Earl to your little party. It's a whole organization we're talking about. This guy looking for your sport coat is part of a syndicate. You know what that means? Organized crime. That's why they call it organized. Guys like him have legitimate businesses mixed with illegitimate ones. He's not just one guy. He's an operator. He's got employees working for him. He runs a factory. The drugs they sell at your flagpole, they don't come packaged. They come to this country raw. They need to be prepared, prepped, and packaged just like you'd package aspirin or soda pop to sell in a store. This guy's operation runs all the way from Queens to Georgia. It's something you can't get in the way of. Are you interested in doing that?
The police? Us?
Yes. Well, you got us wrong, she said tersely. All's we want is our Christmas club money.
He laughed.
What are you talking about? You step in the middle of a major Brooklyn drug operation and send the drug king's muscle man home by subway with a lump on his head the size of Philadelphia. You threaten the same muscle man by saying you know his dead minister father. All for your church club money? He came here courting trouble, she said angrily, and them's hard dollars in our church club money. Nobody knows how much is in there. Whatever it is, it's not enough to risk your skin. You have no idea what you're dealing with, Potts said. You don't live here, she said bitterly. I know Deem's whole family. His grandfather, Mr. Lewis, was a hard man. But it's a hard life out here. He came to New York from Kentucky with 10 cents in his pocket. He swept and mopped in office for 40 years till he died. And then his wife passed. His daughter prayed in this church every Sunday for years. Between you and me, she drinks like a fish and ain't worth a nickel. It was her son, Mr. Lewis's grandson Deems. He was the gem of that family. He was the one with all the promise. That boy could throw a ball better than anybody around here. He had the chance to get out on account of just that one thing. Now, he's going to die or go to jail, which amounts to the same thing. Once Deems comes out of prison, if he lives long enough to go in, he'll be worse than he was when first he gone in. Back and forth he'll go. None of that fits in your little reports and warrants, does it? When the newspaper writes their little stories about coloreds and Spanish swinging around Brooklyn like a bunch of monkeys in trees, none of that gets in there, now does it?
You don't have to eat my head off about it. The Irish got kicked and booted the same way.
We ain't talking about them.
No,
we're not. You were talking about the church money. It's got nothing to do with this trouble, Potts said. It's got everything to do with it. That Christmas club money is all we can control. We can't stop these drug dealers from selling poison in front of our houses. Or make the city stop sending our kids to lousy schools. We can't stop folks from
blaming us for everything gone wrong in New York, or stop the army from calling our sons to Vietnam after them Viet Cong done cut the white soldiers' toenails too short to walk. But the little nickels and dimes we saved up so we can give our kids 10 minutes of love at Christmas time, that's ours to control. What's wrong with that? She waved at the weeded lot, the projects nearby, the elephant's old boxcar on the next block,